This is a HeadGum Podcast.
All Jane Austen novels are the same.
All Jane Austen novels
are the same.
I said all Jane Austen, all Jane Austen novels. Novels are the same. All Jane Austen, all Jane Austen novels. Novels are the same.
Relaxing by the fireplace and reading through Emma. But you're out of wine, so now you got yourself a dilemma. Start your car and cross your fingers that you won't have to troubleshoot. Or curl up on the sofa and sign up for Club W. They bring booze straight to you like the comic that's bombing. And they promise you'll have no problem. Something we got in common, that's common sense.
And sensibility.
Let their wine fill your chalices. They'll give you custom choices if you just take their palate quiz. Buying wine in stores is a game that you lose. So don't stay married to it like your name's Lady Susan. Got a discount just to thank you all for being supporters. Use our handy site for $20 off your order. Buy four or more bottles, shipping's on the house, what a steal. Get it anywhere in the country from Seattle to Mansfield. Park online at clubw.com/Gilmore. Guys, start swallowing their beverages instead of your pride and prejudice.
And that sweet little ditty. Ba-ba.
Ba-ba.
You can tell only one of us in the room is a singer. Welcome to Gilmore Gabs. I'm Kevin.
I'm Demi.
And we're the Gilmore Gabs. Gabs.
Well, we're the Gilmore Gabrielles.
Is that what Gabs is short for?
Yes.
We're the Gilmore Gabrielle Unions. Yes, indeed. Here for another episode in our series of interviews with people who worked on the show, involved on the show in some way, in some fashion, in some capacity. I'm talking grips, I'm talking actors, I'm talking Amy Sherman, not yet.
People who walked by the set one day.
People who took a studio tour at the WB.
Yeah.
And I'm also talking musicians. Now, we've had a few musicians on the show before, right? I mean, Keiko, technically a musician.
Yeah, Sam Phillips.
A drummer. Grant Lee Phillips. These are all terrific musicians. There is one musician whose voice you hear in every single episode of this podcast by nature of the fact that we sing the theme song of Gilmore Girls, soon to be Gilmore Girls colon, A Year in the Life, every single episode. And let's introduce that special guest right now.
La la. La la, a special guest.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, she is a singer, songwriter, and she is one half of the vocals of Where You Lead, the theme song to Gilmore Girls. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Louise Goffin.
Woo. I am so glad to be here, and I have to say to the listeners that these are the cutest guys ever. I'm sitting here getting the best show. They're awesome. I could just sit here watching them and listening to them sing.
It is a bummer that it's not a video podcast.
Yeah.
Every single episode.
Yeah, you're wasting all those good looks.
Yes, exactly. Well, Louise, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. What a delight to have you in the studio, in person.
So wonderful. And you're singing to Sam Phillips, which is great, too. Her papas.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
I can't wait. That's one of the things I'm most excited for the new episodes, is what's the new Sam Phillips cues? What are they going to sound like?
They're more electronic.
It's all dubstep.
Yeah.
Sam Phillips goes in a very different direction in the new Netflix episodes. That would be insane. Well, Louise, we wanted to talk to you because you're such an integral part, literally one of the voices we hear every single episode in Gilmore Girls, because you are one of the singers of the theme song of Where You Lead.
It's something, too, to see, because the show is so well done, and sometimes I'll be watching it and I'll get really sucked into the drama and the acting, and, you know, I love the banter, all the dialogue, and then all of a sudden I come on singing and it freaks me out.
It's like, whoa, there I am.
Oh yeah, I forgot.
So how did the theme song come about? So this is, let's rewind it way back 15, 16, 17 years ago, whenever it was. They're making a pilot. They're making Gilmore Girls for the WB. No one knows if it's going to go yet. Amy Sherman-Palladino's writing it. And how did your involvement come about?
Well, like most things in life, it all starts with a phone call. I got a phone call from my mother, Carol King, and I was at the time in my kitchen, and I think my son was not even one, and he was still not mobile. He was at the point where I had a sheet on the carpet where he crawled, or he wasn't even crawling yet. He was sitting, and it would just be a ball, and I just watch him and make food, and I was sitting there, and the phone rang, and I'm kind of drifting out the window, and my mother says, "Oh, I have a friend, Amy, and she's got a pilot for the show about a mom and a daughter, and she thought it would be a great idea if we sung a song of mine together because it would follow along with the theme. Are you up for it?" And I said, "Yeah, that sounds like fun," because, basically all I'd been doing was staying up all night rocking a baby and trying to get him to sleep. And she is always very protected. I should say she's always managing expectations. And she said, "Listen, you know, it's just a pilot. Chances are high that this is not going to go anywhere, you know?" So I went in and I actually pitched my then boyfriend, who was the father of my child, to produce it, because we had been working together and I trusted him in the studio. And we went and we did it in my house in Laurel Canyon. We basically had just set up a studio because I had started to record a record for DreamWorks. And the studio was set up in what used to be my bedroom that I just moved out of because I had a baby and we needed more space. And then the mics were set up in what used to be the laundry room. And my mom came over and sung her parts. And then I went in the laundry room and sung my harmonies and sung my parts. So
wasn't a demo. This was the song.
Oh, this was a song. It was all a family affair. And it was all in, you know, this little bungalow in Laurel Canyon where I used to live. And it was just super fun. And then it went off and, you know, I didn't think about it. And then,
Is that where all the instruments were recorded too? In
everything,
house?
Yeah.
Okay, wow. Yeah. Are you playing any instruments on the tracks?
I'm not playing on that. I think Greg Wells, who produced it, is playing on it.
Okay, all the instruments
and stuff.
And
possibly Carol played piano. Mm-hmm. I can't remember.
Who could say?
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll listen to it closer next time and we'll try to suss it out.
Yeah.
Suss out all the details. So it gets sent off. Who knows what it could turn into.
Right. And then I knew that the show was a big hit and a success, but I was never a television watcher, which is, you know, here we are talking about a TV show.
Right.
I lived in London for 10 years and I was completely out of touch with American pop culture because I was not getting all the same pop culture TV. And then when I moved back to LA, which was 1995, I was playing catch up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, musicians, we can be very self-involved sometimes. You know, we're staying up all night working on lyrics, working on these changes, and there's always a long to-do list, which watching TV doesn't always come on, you know, the top of that list.
Yeah, I mean, as a musician, culturally, do you feel more of a need to, like, get into the newest hits of what's out there, the newest music? Like, what do you feel any sort of responsibility to, like, quote-unquote, educate yourself culturally?
I don't know about culturally. For all the things people don't like about the streaming services, well, basically that musicians are not getting paid anymore, and music's so accessible, I find it very handy for research. The research of what I like is really the heading. Because what you do is you go on, you find one act you like, and you're listening to their song, and then you try to, you set up a radio station, and it suggests things that sound like that. I love that, because then I discover a lot of new things out there. But I'm not interested in discovering things because other people like them ever. I only am interested in discovering things because I want to find something I really love.
Right. Oh, so kind of operating like in a vacuum of your own taste.
Yeah.
That's cool, because then you make really interesting discoveries that way.
I guess so. When you put it, when you frame it that way, it sounds more antisocial, but... Yeah.
No, but then you get to share with other people and then invite, and then you get to recommend it to other people.
Yeah.
And it is a social conversation that you're participating in.
Yeah. So. I mean, you know, I guess artists and musicians tend to go to the beat of their own drum. So, you know, I'm keeping with that.
What kind of music do you feel like you really gravitate towards in general?
Well, I'm very much a product of the time I grew up in, and I liked LPs. Mm-hmm. I liked gatefolds. I liked paper. I like design, artwork. I like records with segues. You know, I'm talking like the Beatles, Abbey Road. I like things that have weird little pieces, and it's a whole story. It's almost like a musical from beginning to end. I loved Prince's Parade. It just had some interesting musical things that it went to that wasn't a single here, a single there. You know, we're with Spotify and Pandora and all of that, what people put out is one song mm-hmm. and make their own playlists.
Right.
And they don't ever hear what the artist intended for a piece of work, you know. And artists don't feel compelled to invest all that time so much anymore because they think, well, who's going to listen to it? Why should I spend 6 months on a record when I'm going to put out a single, and then 2 months after I put it out, people will be bored and want to know what my next big statement is. So
yeah, it's hard because the streamification of music has decontextualized the album as a statement mm-hmm. a lot. When it's fun to hear the 70s things, like, for instance, Born to Run would be an example
yeah.
of that.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, this is definitely like, it's almost like a three-act structure and side A. Or the thing that blows my mind, because I recently just got a vinyl player in my house, the thing that blows my mind is the way that albums used to be programmed, side A and side B, mm-hmm. almost like an intermission in the middle of a play, where it's like, oh, the end of side A is a significant break.
Very much.
Or a significant song, and people don't do that.
I just went through that.
Oh, yeah?
Because I am putting out a record called The Essential Louise Goffin Volume 1.
Okay.
And very much when we were putting it together, and I employed the help of Marvin Etzioni, and he is a wonderful songwriter, and I reached out to him. He's a producer as well, so he's very good at having the objectivity of, you know, what the artist is trying to say, how, and an incredible knowledge of, you know, just pop music history and vinyl. Yeah, I guess you could say vinophile.
A vinophile, sure.
So we very much, he said, you know, 10. Side A, what are the first five songs and what are the second five songs? And I said, well, I don't know if we're doing vinyl. This may just be CD, but we still continue to talk about things. In fact, the little napkin at the mastering date with the notes on it still had songs 1 through 5, mm-hmm. and side B was another 1 through 5. So that is a way of thinking, and you're right. It also had to do with time. Once you had a CD, people started putting more songs on a CD. There'd start to be 14 songs or 16 songs, or you could even do 23 songs. But with a record, you would lose sound as you got to the closer to the inside.
Mm-hmm.
The revolutions per minute, you'd have to have, you know, you'd have a less of a space to go
right,
around.
Right.
And the sound quality, the closer you got, would worsen.
Oh, is that true? I didn't know that.
Yeah, so you wouldn't want to get too close to the middle by sticking a sixth track on.
Oh, gotcha.
And you also would want to put songs with certain dynamics, you know, right. not so close to the end. So, I mean, that's what I've been told as I remember it from engineers. So I think you'd want... What is the total of time per side? I mean, I seem to remember something in the region of 37, 39 minutes, mm-hmm. you know, for the whole 10 songs.
Do you know?
No, I was just going to say, I'm sure it's different between a 45 RPM record and a 33, though.
Oh, that's yeah. true. Yeah.
I hope you won't be getting letters. Sorry.
No. I was just going to say 33 is the lower quality, right?
Well, I don't know about quality. I just know revolutions.
Right.
So... I don't know if it's a different quality. All I know is the 45s. They go back further, and yeah. you hear a lot more scratches on them. But that could only be because they're older.
Gotcha.
In producing an album with side A and side B, do you think of it more as like side A is a certain type of song, and then side B is a transition into a different style, or is it just like how do you decide what goes on what side?
You mentioned the three-act play. It's kind of like a two-act play in an odd way. And it is a little bit, you know, it's kind of like, I think of it as the dark side and the light side.
Ooh, okay.
But it doesn't have to be that way. They are separate halves of a whole. Often side B will start with an up-tempo song as if, you know, you had an intermission.
Right.
A little bit like that. But it's different. But you do, when you used to put vinyl together, and people who still do, you do think of it in terms of there's going to be a pause at the end of side one. People will have to stop and turn the record over.
Right.
So they will not be listening to five into six straight away if they're listening on vinyl. And you take that into consideration when you're thinking about how they're going to experience what you're giving them.
Yeah, and it makes listening so much more of an active activity rather than a passive one. Like, oh, I'll just let the stereo play, whatever. But then it's like, no, okay, it's done. I have to go flip it over, do the next four songs, and then you're really paying attention. I feel like Arcade Fire is really good at still making albums as statements these days. Yeah. Do you think Radiohead still does albums as statements?
Oh, for sure.
For sure?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, this is interesting. I was with some kids who were graduating high school, and we were talking about music. There were about six of them there. And I was saying this to them about how music now on streaming, people just want to listen to singles. Mm-hmm. And every one of them said they don't do that. They said when they like an artist, they add the entire record to their playlist and they listen to the whole record. And that was surprising to me because that's not what we're told. We're told people of a certain age, you know, they have no attention spans and they only want to hear singles and they're on to the next thing. And maybe I got lucky with this group of kids, but every one of them said they listen to the whole record. So I feel like people want that. They want depth.
Yeah.
They want to stick with someone.
I think ideally it's always if you can make it so a single works on its own and as part of an album, that's the best occasion. But I also think there's a lot of value still that people see in seeing an album as a whole and not being able to just go on the road and put an album on shuffle. When you make an album now, do you think more of making good singles, or do you still think of it as a whole piece of work that you have to? Like,
I think of it as a whole piece of work. But I also think that each song that you choose to put on it is important.
Right.
And I don't think in the old school record company way anymore, where they used to say single and then they'd say album track,
right,
or filler or any of those words.
Filler.
To me, what's a single? I mean, what it used to be was, okay, we need something that we can do a major advertising campaign mm-hmm. for. We need a single with, you know, it's like the movie poster.
Yeah.
What's the poster going to be? So all this money would go behind the single. But now, I mean, I'm the record company. So who am I doing that for?
Right.
And really, this thing of up-tempo. I mean, maybe when you have a show, you want upbeat things. But people fall in love with songs that are slow. And, I mean, Coldplay has tons of very, you know, melancholic songs on their records that are amazing and people love. And Radiohead, Kid A, is just filled with that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no reason to make things the way in the 80s people did, where it was this great big branding, you know, Michael
right.
Jackson and Madonna, and there had to be this huge look and dancers. You know, a single can be whatever you want that is a story and has something to say. And if people find it in the same way they'd find anything else, they could fall in love with it at any tempo.
How do you feel like songwriting has changed from when you started working to now in terms of your own process and also some of the trends you may have noticed in other people in music in general?
You know, I actually think there's more amazing artistry than I can remember. There's just so much. And constantly I'm hearing something from someone I've never heard of that's great. There's just so much out there. I mean, it's hard to know where to go and how to find it because everything's been laid out with so much information and content that we're constantly dealing with throughout our day. How does the red arrow get pointed? Got to check this band out. It's usually word of mouth or just, you know, stumbling on it through looking through playlists and things like that. So I find that the songwriting is of a very high level. What I don't find so much, and I think this has always existed, it's not new, is when the pop market, when you have 4, 5, 6 songwriters on a song and someone's doing the track and then someone else is doing the top line and then mm-hmm. a producer comes in and, you know, there's this saying in songwriters circles, a word for a third, meaning, you know, someone comes in, they throw one word in and then they want a third of the song. And
oh, yeah.
Nowadays it's all a business. So if you write a song and there's 5 people in a song and then you get such and such an artist to sing it who doesn't really write full time, but they want to change a line here and there, it's kind of implied, well, I'll get writing credit and publishing on this song for singing it. There's all those little business deals that go on. Those don't make the songs better, those kind of situations where it's just, you know, let's find the most compromise possible so that people will pay for this and advertise it and everyone will be happy.
Mm-hmm. They turn songwriting into like a science of sorts of yes. just 1,000 different chemicals to try and make the perfect formula instead of just an emotional thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Songwriting is best done with absolute brutal honesty. And, you know, I like collaborating. I think it's great when you collaborate because you get both people's life experience and you get it in, you know, this very dynamic way because you're in the moment and you have to come up with something because someone else is in the room. And I think those always work best when you trust the person you're mm-hmm. with and you respect the person you're with and you're able to say, I don't like that line. No, forget yeah. that. Or you make jokes with, you know, lines that you know you'll throw out, but they just rhyme and they're funny and you get beyond your left brain.
Mm-hmm.
To me, those bring the best songs.
It's like those pure collaborations and the honesty that comes from those moments.
Yeah, it's basically, I like that. Oh, I love that idea. It's not coming from, what will the market like? Or what do you think the record company will go for? And you don't do that. You don't second guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first time you wrote music?
The circumstances.
Obviously, you grew up in a musical environment, we can assume.
Yeah, I don't know if I can put it down to the first song I wrote. Actually, I can remember first song I recorded. There was a couple. I have it somewhere. First of all, my father, Larrabee Sound Studios, used to be on Santa Monica. It's no longer there. Mm-hmm. It's one of, I think it's that pub or bar called Blazing Saddles or, you know, somewhere there. And it used to be Larrabee. It was a bank. He turned it into a recording studio with a partner. And when I was 8 years old, I used to get on the back of his motorcycle going down Laurel Canyon. Mm-hmm. And we'd go in there and hang out. And I recorded a session with a girlfriend of mine where we did a Beatles song. I played Get Back by the Beatles on Ooh. Piano. And then we had a couple songs that we'd written together. And they were quite good. And I think I was like 8 years old when that was recorded.
You were 8?
Yeah.
Wow.
I think it was 8. It was not earlier because we didn't move to California until I was 8. Yeah.
So this was not like, this was part of your blood from like the start, it sounds like.
Oh,
just music and musicality and songwriting and
absolutely.
Constantly making things.
Yeah. Yeah. I really wanted to write songs. I remember I started to take piano when I was 5 and I was reading music a little bit, but as soon as I had enough to work with to put them together, you know, put chords together and musical phrases into a song, I was like, forget the music. What can I do with these chords? So mm-hmm. I had that gene big time.
Do you sight read at all, or are you?
I sight read a bit. I can look at music and know that's a C and roughly figure out what the timing is, but you wouldn't be able to put a piece of music in front of me and have me follow along. I could decipher it, make notes, and then it would later remind me of mm-hmm. how the song went.
Yeah, so you work on more of an instinctual basis.
Yeah. Yeah, I write guides more than I write charts. I know what chords to write. I know how to make those bar lines. I know mm-hmm. how to count. And in fact, I do come up with really sophisticated music and chords. I just don't always know what they're called. I have to figure them out after I've written them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What does your songwriting process look like now? Like, how does that work out? Is it a daily thing? You have to sit down like, okay, it's time to work. Or do you wait for the muse to strike?
I wish it was a daily thing. The muse to strike, I think the muse is always there, honestly. You know, this thing called fear of music is a real thing. When I'm thinking about writing or I'm thinking about performing, I kind of freeze up because I think I don't know how to do this. What am I going to do? How am I going to play? How am I going to write? How am I going to sing? That always happens when I'm not in the process of doing it. But then when I pick up an instrument, I go, oh, well, some part of me knows how to do this. It's not my conscious brain, but something in me is doing this, and I just have to get out of the way of doing it. In terms of writing, my process is put together a bit like what I can tolerate in my personality, which is I'm fairly impatient, so I like to come up with a lot of ideas by the fly and throw them together. It'll just kind of mix and match, going, well, that phrase will go with that phrase, and it's like scotch tape and paper practically. So I'll throw it all together, and then I love editing.
Editing you like. Some people don't like editing.
I love editing. I have a very detailed and hyper-focused brain after that process of throwing things together. So, you know, I start with the impatient part, like, how can I put this together and get a song mm-hmm. as easily with the least amount of stress and left brain possible? And then I start going through it and going, that word, don't need, that phrase isn't as good. This is a great first line, need a middle eight. And then I get to the nitty gritty. So it's kind of more rewriting than writing for me.
And refining rather than refining. Bursting out of you the first go.
Yeah, so that's me.
And what represents the best part of all of making music for you at this point? Would it be the actual writing of it? Is it laying it on the track? Is it performing it for an audience to hear for the first time?
I think my favorite part is making records. I love it. I really do. And playing live is fun. It's just a lot of work because you have to travel. You got to, you know, keep track of every single thing that's important, a little mini jack that's this big. If you don't have it, how am I going to play my Casio? You know, you really have to be organized with that. What I love about recording is I usually start a lot of it in my backyard mm-hmm. in you know, a little room that's like 8 by 12 feet. It's like a little treehouse room, or even working with friends. I mean, I work right down the street from here mm-hmm. with one of my collaborators. And
another clue to where we record on Gilmore. Guys.
Well, no.
Yeah. Oh, clues. Yeah. They're going to come find you, the fans.
I know.
I say let them.
Let them, because we're also leaving this building in like 2 months. So it's okay.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. I really love recording. I love the part where you just make it sound sonically how you want mm-hmm. it to sound. And I love, it's like a big family. Really, it feels like every time I am recording and working with people, I love the people I work with so much. It's just like, you know, a great gathering of
wonderful people. Yeah, how'd you find your crew?
Well, they're out there. I'm always meeting more people, but what amazes me is decades can go by, you know, when you haven't seen someone mm-hmm. and you see them, and it really feels like home. It feels like you're going back home and you're speaking a common language. And in spite of the fact that you've gone through different experiences and you know, maybe their kids have grown up and all these things have happened at the moment that you're making music together. It's this common bond, and it's like a brotherhood, sisterhood. It's just an amazing feeling.
Are there any like covers you guys like to play by default when you get together, particular styles or genres you like to work in?
I haven't played a lot of covers. In fact, right now I'm doing a show soon and I've been having to come up with a list of possible covers. And what ends up happening is you think, well, this has been done before. How am I going to give this a spin that's different enough that it justifies doing this song that has totally been done incredibly before? And then I end up going, what's more interesting than that is to do this original song that no one's heard.
Yeah.
So, you know, doing covers well and revisioning them and not just doing another version of, you know, Good Lovin' by the Young Rascals is to really come up with a spin on things. But I did have the opportunity to do covers with songs that my mother, Carole King, and my father, Jerry Goffin, wrote. My father, Jerry, passed away June of 2014. He was 75. And it still is the oddest thing for me, you know, because I've been singing his songs and playing his songs, which are his words, you know, singing his words, which so much come out of the way he thinks and, you know, his personality and his heart, that it just feels like, well, how could he not be here, you know, because right, he feels so present. And it's a really great gift that he's given me for me to be able to sing these incredible words. So I did some songs that he and my mother wrote on a record couple years ago. Then I found a song that I'd never knew they'd written that was a demo that somebody put up on YouTube the day he died. And I was like, what's this? And nobody had ever heard it in my family. In fact, we couldn't even figure out what the words were. And he was always behind the scenes lyric writer, but he's singing lead vocal on it.
Oh, wow.
So there was this whole stage of his life. This was 1973, where he thought, if Bob Dylan can sing, I can sing. So he made a double record where he's singing all the vocals. And then he was obviously singing on this demo. And my mother, who, you know, a couple years after this demo became hugely famous with Tapestry, she's singing the harmony against his Dylan-esque lead vocal. So I covered that song. I was like, okay, this is just raw treasure I found here. I've got to do this song. And I reached out to Joseph Arthur in Brooklyn, and he said, yeah, I'll sing on it. I love it. So I was out in New York and went to see him, and he did an incredible part, his duet part on it, which sounds very similar to my father. A few people were like, whoa, that sounds like Jerry.
Wow.
And he's great. He's amazing. So I felt very fortunate to have him on that. And then recently, Sony ATV Publishing came to me and said, hey, you've been doing these Goffin King songs on our catalog. We want you to do more. Because if you do The Locomotion and you Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman and you do I Feel the Earth Move, then we can send this to people and say, hey, what do you think of using this new master of these songs?
Oh, that's right, the new master, because then that would... What's the technical benefit of that again?
Well, they don't own the original master.
Right.
They just own the song. But this was a way that we could have masters that they could actually pitch.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I was a cover artist for some of those songs. So, again, those are old songs that I was able to redo and revision, and that was really fun.
What was the twist, like you were saying before, what were the justification for the reason for doing it again? What was the twist you found with those songs that made it worth revisioning?
Well, Natural Woman, I did in a way that it paid homage to Aretha Franklin's record in terms of the arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are just amazing arrangements on that record. The string parts, the, you know, you make me feel, and then the horns, da, ba, 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 all of that. I'm not pitch perfect here.
Sound good to me.
Thank you. Yeah, just to pay homage to all of that, but I did it in my key. I had elements of the version on Tapestry, which was more slow, singer-songwriter. I felt like I couldn't redo it and not take into consideration the parts of it that had already been brilliant. I didn't want to reinvent the wheel and just, you know, I got to be honest. If you asked me to redo some songs in my parents' catalog, I would not have touched Natural Woman. I'd go, well, nope, Aretha's done that. Nobody ever needs to record that song again. That's it. You know, right. That's a definitive version. But they requested it, and I was at first nervous. I thought, how am I going to do this? And then when we went to cut it, I was amazed at how in my DNA and natural it was for me to sing it. And I got beyond the, oh, I'm competing with Aretha and I'm going to lose in that by a long shot. It got to be, oh, I'm bringing my own thing to this and I'm not competing with anybody. It's just, I've got this amazing song and my parents wrote it. How incredible is that? And I'm singing it with all this love. So that's how that went about. And then Locomotion is really great because I actually started with that using a Johnny Marr riff from How Soon Is Now from the Smiths, which is like, you know, it's got the kind of bow diddly thing. And that's not in the song anymore. I mean, that was just, I want to do it like that. So we started off.
It was a basis or a foundation.
Yeah, it was this is the way I'd like to do that. So it's kind of punky. It's a little bit of a punkier version than the original.
It's very fun.
Yeah.
And even just talking about, in general, your relationship with your parents musically growing up, how did that work out? Because sometimes when people are in the business of show, they like to shield their kids from that, keep them from it. Oh, it's work, it's personal, or like, I don't want this life for you because I know how hard it can be from time to time. So how did that work itself out?
Well, they didn't have a choice. I mean, I was just chomping at the bit. It really felt like, okay, all right, God, I know why I was born to these parents because I want to do this job. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what better place on the planet to be than, you know, if this is what I want to do for a living. I mean, I never thought that till I was way, way down the line of having done it, but I'm still as passionate about it as I was when I was a kid and a teenager. I still feel, you know, that same fire that I always felt. So it's very much ingrained in me to want to do this. So when I was 12, my mother had this quote-unquote serious conversation with me.
At 12.
To discourage me from what my life plan was, which by that point was already very determined.
This is 4 years after you recorded for the first time.
Oh, yeah.
If we remember, at 8 years old.
Oh, yeah. I was doing a lot. I was doing, I was on the piano all the time, yeah, and writing songs and, I, you know, singing, and I'd done more recording by then. She was worried, and this was a year after Tapestry, so I guess her thinking was, it's going to be really hard for you to follow in my footsteps after, I don't know what it was. It was out of love and concern, and it was also out of, it could be really hard for you kind of thing, which, honestly, when I was that age, I was like, what is she talking about? You know, I'm just doing what I'm doing. And I was never put together in a way to think about what other people liked. You asked me the question at the beginning of the interview, you know, do you research and do work to try to stay up to date with what people like? I never was that way. I think I've always been much in a vacuum of, well, I don't care what people like. I just want to be really good at this. Right. I just want to write songs I am proud of. And I've always come from that place. And it wasn't until I'd been doing that a really long time that I realized, oh, if you don't do things that other people really like, and, you know, you're not going to the beat of the drum of what pop culture is, then you won't have a record deal, and you won't eat, and you won't be able to live your life, and you won't be able to give up your waitressing job. You know, it didn't all add up to that till much later. But I always came from a place of gotta be as good as that song, gotta sound as good as that artist. You know, that was really my MO. So when she said that to me, like, it might be hard for you, I didn't know what she was talking about, because it didn't fit into my whole thing of, well, I don't understand. I'm just working really hard and doing what I can to get better at this. And why would what other people feel have anything to do with that process? I didn't even say it like that. I was like, I don't care. Leave my room.
Yeah, you were 12.
Okay.
Like, I'm going to write this into a song.
Cool.
Yeah. All right.
Oh, yeah. And what a potent relationship for a song as well. And we were talking earlier about recontextualizing different songs and different covers. Even the song Where You Lead became recontextualized in the version that you and your mother did for the show.
She and I were just talking about that, because we're performing it live in Hyde Park in London this summer.
How fun.
She's playing Tapestry, mm-hmm. and she asked me to sing that with her.
Oh, we got to go to London, dude.
Yeah.
Got the budget? Sponsors, listen. We want the Gilmore guys there.
Squarespace, send us to London to see Carole King and Louise Goffin.
Yeah. Imagine what you can have on your Squarespace website.
Yeah, exactly. That's the new soundbite for Squarespace ads.
Okay. So maybe there's a job here for me, guys.
Hey, listen.
So, we were talking about it because on Tapestry, it was about a man. And she said she didn't even want to sing it after a while, because she didn't want to sing, you know, hey, it was very non-empowered woman. Hey, where you lead, I will follow, anywhere that you tell me to, you know, with the guy.
And she believed that it was inherently a song. She wrote it to be about a guy at the beginning.
She felt like that's how it was. And then she said when we did it for the Gilmore Girls, it became about a relationship with your daughter. And I wrote about this recently, but to me, that famous classic children's book, The Runaway Bunny, mm-hmm. if you go there, I will find you. If you run away, I will come after you because you are my little bunny.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the song Where You Lead in the Gilmore Girls context became a different version of The Runaway Bunny. It's like, anywhere you go, where you lead, I will follow. If you're the parent, you'd say that about your kid.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's so funny that, like, the context, the recontextualization of a duet can do that to that song. And I'm sure so many songs would have a very different flavor and feel given, like, if it wasn't done by just a solo performer. Yeah. So that's so interesting that that music and especially that song was that malleable mm-hmm. to withstand that new story that it could tell in that context. Because I think for most people of the Gilmore generation, that's only what the song is. Like the idea that it's about a guy is the furthest thing. It's almost like not part of the conversation at all anymore. You know what I mean?
Oh, and the opening shots are so beautiful. I mean, I did see the episode where she falls into her mother and, you know, where they're, you know, she leans into her mm-hmm. shoulder. Yeah, it's just a beautiful, loving bond of a montage in the beginning of it. You know, you talk about recontextualizing and revisioning. It's interesting because Chris Seyfried, who produced all the three Goffin and King songs with me that we just mm-hmm. did, he and I just did this little New York, you know, unplugged thing. And we played those songs. And we did Natural Woman different than we did it on the record. We did it almost like a cowboy song. You know, will you make me feel? And it was just like, you know, sitting around the campfire.
Yeah.
And it worked amazing. It was very intimate. And you can take a, a great song and do it so many different ways, and it will always hold up.
Mm-hmm. If the song is built for it and good enough for it, then it's gonna mm-hmm. check out. Well, we'd love to hear some music from you. If
All
you
right.
might be so kind to yeah. grace us with maybe a song, maybe something from your new record.
Yeah, absolutely. I brought my ukulele.
Yes, so Louise brought into the studio a gorgeous case, I'm sure holding a gorgeous ukulele inside of it, so we'll set up the microphone for that now. Sounds good. Now, what are we about to hear?
Well, this beautiful ukulele here that Kala provided me with when I broke mine.
Oh, no!
I tried, you know, I went to South by Southwest, and it's tough being a musician because when you travel by air, you can only take so much with you. So I was trying to get my guitar pedals and bring a guitar and then get my uke in my suitcase.
Oh.
And when I got there, my uke was cracked.
Oh, no.
So when I got back, I called Kala and they said, all right, we'll get you a uke. And
oh, it's so kind.
It's wonderful. Yeah.
So I, anyway, this is a song on my record. The record, I should say, it's called The Essential Louise Goffin Volume 1, and it's a compilation of cherry-picked songs from my last three records with a remix and everything remastered, but there are three songs on it that have not come out before.
Never before heard.
Yeah.
Great.
Any featuring the ukulele?
Yes. All this right. song called Main Street Parade.
Main Street Parade.
Big balloons soaring high, all floating down the lane. What to do? I lost you in your Main Street parade. The streamers stream, the people scream, and the children smile and wave. It's not complicated. I don't need a big production. All I want is your sweet loving. Another night of fireworks exploding in your sky. Sleight of hand, I'm looking up instead of in your eyes. You make it complicated. See, I don't need a big production. All I want is your sweet loving. Stop the crowd pushing and shoving. No, 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 no. All I want is your sweet loving. We learn to forgive when we make mistakes. Sometimes we give, sometimes we take. But every morning when I wake, I see big balloons soaring high, or floating down the lane. What to do? I lost you in your Main Street parade. It's not complicated. I don't need a big production. All I want is your sweet loving. I can't stop the crowd pushing and shoving. Sweet loving. So what to do? I lost you in your Main Street Parade.
That was fantastic.
Oh,
that was so good.
That was lovely. I love the sound of that ukulele, yeah. too. Oh, my goodness.
Thank you.
It's a beautiful sunburst color on the ukulele, and oh, the cording is so lovely.
Thank you.
So, so cool. Well, Louise, thank you so much for joining us today on the show.
Now, you go out with this theme song.
We do. Oh, yeah.
We do.
And before that, where can people find you on the internet? Where can they find your stuff? What do you have to plug?
Oh,
all
yeah.
that jazz?
Okay, well, my Twitter is at Louise Goffin, but okay. I'm not so much a tweeter.
Not so much a tweeter.
Yeah. Instagram, I'm Lula Hoop.
Lula Hoop, okay.
And my Facebook page is Louise Goffin.
Okay.
At Louise Goffin.
And people can find all the music and all the news.
Yes,
there.
But what everybody should know is that I'm launching a pledge campaign this week. And go look for me on Pledge for the Essential Louise Goffin Volume 1 goes to London to play Hyde Park. And I'm going to have amazing behind-the-scenes footage of going to London and the BBC and incredible stuff. And we have really rare exclusives.
Terrific.
So, yeah, come follow.
Come follow. Well, where you lead, we will follow. So shall we? Let's do the full version. Then, yeah. And then we'll come in on the... on the second verse.
Okay.
That's, sound good?
Yeah.
Okay, let's
All right,
do it.
I'm putting them on the fly here. This
yeah.
is good.
Oh, this is fun.
That's
living,
great. Keep us
we're
on our
living
toes.
Dangerously here.
Here
you know?
We go.
This is, you think this is taped? Well, let me tell you. They're really...
This is live and raw.
This is live and raw.
Oh,
okay,
it feels
here,
good.
And you know, I could even make mistakes because I just taught myself this. So it's an exciting
anything
podcast.
Anything could happen.
Yeah, anything.
It's like Saturday Night Live.
Exactly. Okay. Ready?
Oh, yeah. Here we yeah. go.
Loving you the way I do, I only want to be with you, and I would go to the ends of the earth, 'cause darling, to me that's what you're worth. Where you lead, I will follow anywhere that you tell me to. If you need me to be with you, I will follow where you lead.
If you're out on the road feeling lonely and so cold, all you have to do is call my name and I'll be there on the next train. Choo-choo, where you lead, I will follow anywhere that you tell me to. If you need me to be with you, I will follow where you lead.
I always wanted a real heart with flowers on the windowsill.
But honey, if you wanna live in Stars Hollow,
then you know I will.
Yes, I will. Yes, I will. I always thought I could get satisfaction from just one man, but anyone could keep me happy. You're the ones who can.
Where you lead, I will follow anywhere that you tell me to. If you need me to be with you, I will follow. Oh, 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 where you lead, I will follow.
Everybody,
anywhere that you tell me to. If you need me to be with you, I will follow. Where you lead,
I will follow. Where you lead.
Yay! I like that song.
I love that song.
Okay, that was, you got to say, that was just like the best version ever.
I think
best
so.
Best version ever. That's
you guys
definitive.
Sounded great.
As did you, of course. Thank you, Louise, for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.